Welcome to Inspired Money, the live stream podcast featuring inspiring money stories and inspiring lifestyles. Together, we'll learn to make more, give more, and live more. For an interactive experience, join us live at youtube.com/inspiredmoney. Inspired Money is co-created by Runnymede Capital Management and Eagles Vision Creative Collaborative Media Design. We are live in 3, 2, 1.
Aloha, Inspired Money Makers. Welcome to another episode of Inspired Money, the live stream podcast where we want to make the most of our money, lifestyle, and together we can make the world a better place. I'm your host, Andy Wong, a financial advisor, and I'm here to guide you on today's topic, financial independence and retiring early. The FIRE movement has attracted a lot of attention with its bold promise of early retirement, but it's not without its critics. One major criticism is the high savings rate required to achieve financial independence. Saving 50% or more of your income can seem like a daunting or even impossible task, especially for those with high living expenses or debt. Here's what I think. Even if the full FIRE lifestyle isn't for you, the fundamentals can help you manage your savings, income, and expenses better. Financial freedom is a great goal at any age. And today, we're going to talk about how you can incorporate the basics of FIRE into your life. We'll cover the principles of FIRE, the mindset you need, smart ways to manage expenses, investment strategies, and how to create a strong financial plan. Whether you dream of retiring at 40 or just want a more secure financial future, there's something here for everyone. Before we continue, I just want to share an event coming up next week in Chatham, New Jersey. This actually has nothing to do with personal finances, really. On Thursday, July 25th, 2024, I'm presenting Ukulele Masters, featuring award-winning musicians from Hawaii, Herb Ota Jr. and Brian Tolentino. Tickets are on sale. You can see the link, events.humanitix.com/ukulele. And in episode 38 of Inspired Money, The Art of Giving Back, Creative Ways to Make a Difference, we had co-founder of Humanitix, Adam McCurry, on the show, along with Kat Ruschetta. And we had one more person, and I'm totally spacing. My apologies to that guest. But it was The Art of Giving Back, creative ways to Make a Difference. It's really cool because not only does that ticketing platform allow me to collect money and manage my tickets, but they take all their profits, all those ticket convenience fees. Humanitix has lower fees, and then they donate that to a lot of great charities making a difference around the world. So it's a win-win for everybody. I hope that you'll support the event if you're in New Jersey. Let's bring in our panelists. We've got an incredible panel today, consisting of all early retirees. Let me welcome Jakob Lund-Fisker. He's the author of Early Retirement Extreme. The New York Times described him as often thought leader and father of the FIRE movement. As a pioneer of the FIRE movement, he's known for his philosophy of radical frugality and sustainable living to achieve financial independence. Jakob, it's so great to have you, especially since you don't do podcasts that frequently.
Thank you for letting me come in here. Yeah, that's right. it's a rare thing for me to do.
Well, we're delighted to have you, especially I don't talk to physicists that often myself. So I look forward to getting a physicist perspective, especially on financial independence. We have Christy Shen, a world-traveling early retiree. She's co-founder of Millennial Revolution and co-author of the best-selling book, Quit Like a Millionaire. She built a seven-figure portfolio that enabled her to retire in her 30s. And now she helps others to achieve financial independence and travel the world. Christy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy.
And then we have a couple of guests who are back on Inspired Money. Jordan Doc G. Grummet is no stranger to the podcast. He's been on as a one-on-one interviewee, and then also he's been on several times as a panelist. Doc G is host of the Earn and Invest podcast, where he shares insights on achieving financial independence and building wealth through passive income strategies. Jordan, you have a new book coming soon, so welcome back.
Yeah, The Purpose Code comes out in January of 2025. It takes up where Taking Stock, my last book, ended, and it's all about how we find purpose in life. Andy, I'm so happy to be back with this great group of esteemed guests.
It's going to be an incredible conversation. And Chris Mamula, also a previous guest on Inspired Money. He's a personal finance expert. He's an author, advocate for the financial independence, retire early movement. He co-authored the book, Choose FI, Your Blueprint to Financial Independence. Chris, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here with this whole crew. Should be fun.
Well, I look forward to learning from all of you because I think I'm the only person here who's technically really working my 9-to-5. So let's jump right in. We're going to go to segment one.
The FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early, focuses on saving aggressively, investing wisely, and living frugally to achieve financial freedom before the traditional retirement age. Financial independence means having enough wealth to cover living expenses without needing to work, while retiring early allows you to leave the workforce permanently, often well before 60. FIRE enthusiasts typically save 50% to 70% of their income by reducing expenses and maximizing savings. Investments are diversified across stocks, bonds, and real estate to balance risk and return. Minimalism, emphasizing meaningful experiences over material possessions, is a core principle. To achieve financial independence, the Rule of 25 suggests saving 25 times your annual expenses. The 4% rule indicates you can withdraw 4% of your retirement savings annually without depleting your funds. Approaches to FIRE include lean FIRE, extreme frugality, fat FIRE, comfortable living, and barista FIRE, part-time work. These strategies help individuals tailor their path to financial independence and early retirement based on their unique goals.
Jakob, I've heard you say that retirement is not an age or number. And I think that that's a mindset that probably too few people have. Can you talk a little bit about what are the most common misconceptions about the FIRE movement that you've encountered?
Well, I mean, I don't know how it is these days since I don't really pay a whole lot of attention to the FIRE movement, but like 15 years ago, and it's probably still like that in many, many segments of society. The idea was that retirement, you needed like $1 million. So it's just sort of like an arbitrary amount. It's been a million since like forever. And early retirement was something you did at like 55, 60, a few years before, you know, like traditional retirement. And I think my main contribution to what the FIRE movement has become was to do like a mathematical study, sort of like typical physicist style of looking at the like entire parameter space. So I, instead of looking at age or dollar amount, I looked at the savings rate because I kind of realized that it really depends on how much money you want to spend rather than how much money you have. And so I did, instead of going with like the usual 10-30% that you know, professional advisors recommended, I simply calculated everything from 0 to 100%, and it became quite clear that if you save more than 75 to 80% of your paycheck, regardless of how big it was, if you could find a way to live on 20% of what you earned, then you could actually gain financial independence in 5 to 10 years. And that's not a very long working sentence to sort of say. So that essentially turned FIRE or early retirement into something that was for the few to something that was like truly optional for everybody if they wanted it. And the big issue there was, of course, that nobody was really aware of it. A lot of people were in denial about it, especially like the first 5-7 years, even when you talk to like professionals. Like bank advisors, they would flat out deny this is impossible. Nobody can do this. And I would have to sort of like drag them by the ear and show them the math. It's like, look, it's equations that are familiar to you, you know, like, and then they would go back do their own math. It's like, hey, maybe I could do that too. But it was really a sort of like a slug in the beginning.
Well, I like that, especially today, because it seems like that age of retiring at 65, so many people feel like they need to work longer and longer. Right. But absolutely, the amount you spend is a, you know, you have some control over that variable, and then you can calculate the equation. Christy, what inspired you to start your journey towards financial independence and retiring early?
I actually wasn't trying to retire early, and I didn't know anything about financial independence. I was actually trying to buy a house. Having lived in Toronto, one of the most expensive cities in Canada, that was everyone's dream, was to buy a house. And also coming from my background, my parents, basically, housing is their religion. So you kind of get disowned if you don't buy a house. So I didn't want to go into that situation. So what happened was I was tried to save as much money as possible towards a down payment. I was working as a software developer at the time. And what happened was every time I saved money, the housing prices kept going up higher and higher and higher. And on top of that, my work was getting less and less stable. And there was talk of outsourcing. So it was the stress of needing to buy the house, but then also being worried about losing my job. And then work was very stressful to the point where one of my coworkers one day collapsed from stress and almost died at his desk. And that was my wake-up call to kind of shift in a different direction. And that's when I started doing research and discovered what financial independence was. And back then, it wasn't a movement like it was today. It was actually a handful of bloggers. And of course, Jakob's book, everybody knew about that and try to figure out how to become financially independent. There wasn't a lot of examples of non-Americans trying to become financially independent. So luckily, because the amount of money I had saved at the time towards a house was a significant amount. It was $500,000 over multiple years. And I could just pivot that towards financial independence. And instead of being in a massive amount of debt and being worried about losing my job, I ended up becoming financially independent in 3 years, which was faster than the estimated 5 years at the time. And then I quit my job and traveled the world. And now I've been retired for around 10 years now.
So you don't own a home, but mm-hmm. you're free to travel wherever you want.
Correct. Yes. And then another one of the things that ended up surprising me was, so after having a child, so my son right now is just turned 10 months old. And one of the things that I thought would happen was, okay, well, after you have a kid, immediately you need to buy a house. And what ended up happening is I still very much enjoy renting, and I enjoyed the security and stability that the portfolio is giving me. And I have zero plans to buy a house.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. Chris, can you tell us about any significant adjustments you had to make in your lifestyle to achieve FI?
So I have kind of a similar story to Christy. I think like I was on the path. I was saving a lot. I was living a lot of the FIRE principles without knowing that FIRE was a thing. And I think probably all of us found Jakob and then also Pete, Mr. Money Mustache. And it made me realize like, oh my goodness, there's math behind this. And like, you can actually, you know, like he talked about that magical like $1 million number. And I just assumed you had to have, I thought it was more than that. I didn't think you could retire early. So we were just saving a lot just because kind of for us, it felt good. We were kind of in this community, like an outdoor, like dirt bag climber and ski bum community where people just were kind of living their passions. And so we were just saving because we didn't care about the big house and the fancy car, but we didn't really have a goal until we found the FIRE movement. And it did have that that feeling of it had to be this extreme lifestyle. And I do think like when I found early retirement extreme, that was the first blog I found. And I did kind of, even myself, even though I was living it, I felt, wow, this is extreme even for me. But that's kind of what made me want to start writing my story to share it, because I thought, you know, these principles, you don't have to be as extreme, but, you know, as long as you're saving, it's all about, you know, the savings rate, and the math is quite simple, and it scales to whatever lifestyle you want it to look like. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Mm. Jordan, I feel like there's this $1 million number, I think, does kind of live in my head. And then with inflation and everything feeling more expensive, I feel like that's not enough. Maybe I need 2 million. So what's your experience and the listeners of your podcast and the people that you talk to? What is this dollar amount?
So I think if Jakob said he looked at financial independence as a physicist, I would say the exact opposite. I started looking at financial independence as a philosopher. And so what I started realizing is that the number actually didn't matter. The question was, how do I do work? Because I think we do work our whole lives. But what we really want to do is work that we can be autonomous, that we can show some mastery towards. We can do these things we really love doing. You're going to be doing work your whole life. So the question is, how do you build both a financial and life otherwise around doing things you really love doing? And I think this is the reason why a lot of people have trouble with a money amount, a dollar amount, because they have no idea what they really want to do with their lives. And so getting to financial independence is some number, and that number maybe can sustain them physically. But what we're really looking for is to be sustained emotionally. And so financial independence can look much different depending on who you are. So you could have $500,000 and spend $200,000 a year. But if you love being a physicist and you go to your lab every day and you love that job and that job happens to pay you the extra $100,000 or $200,000 a year you need to sustain your lifestyle, in some senses, you've kind of gotten all the things you were trying to get from financial independence, even if you didn't hit some net worth number. So I think the reason why the number continues to escalate is because people really aren't clear about what they want that money to do for them.
Mm. So it does take, it requires a lot of thought and planning.
Yeah, money is a tool. And the question is, what do you want to do with that tool in order to live a life that feels maximally free and enjoyable and purposeful? And so again, we like to really spend a lot of time thinking about the number, but I think the number is almost secondary to what's important to us. How do we want to live our lives? And then let's build a financial framework around that that can support it.
Jakob, you've been at this for a long time. What does living your dream look like? How do you decide when you do some work and when you don't?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's definitely the case that each have like their own dreams and desires and reasons why they do this. I mean, like Christy, I mean, I was not going for the financial independence initially either. I just kind of like eventually found out that it could be like a thing once I started looking into investments, because I had all this money just sitting in a savings account doing like whatever. I didn't know what to do with it. So my original motivation was essentially, I used to be like a sort of like a Star Trek techno optimist astrophysics guy. But when I was in grad school, I discovered like what is now known as the poly crisis. And I decided to see if it was possible to live with a sustainable ecological footprint. And I kind of calculated that to be about $6,000 per person per year in $2,000 in the year 2000. If you do the same calculation today, it's about $6,700 per person per year. And initially that kind of sounded horrible, because I used to be this kind of like earn by consumer, having the latest electronics and so on. But I took it on as a personal challenge. So that kind of gave me my purpose. But since I was like in grad school and earning about 25K a year and only spending 6K, you know, that kind of left me with like 19K, what to do with that, you know, like, so it just kind of like accumulated on a savings account until for 4 years, until I began to consider investments in that sense. So I never really thought of low spending as in any kind of sacrifice or deprivation. I just thought of it as a lifestyle challenge. If it's kind of like, if I can figure out how to do this and I can tell other people how to do this, and basically we would save the planet. So that was my motivation.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Saving the planet is part of your, is part of your mission, doing it sustainably.
Pretty much.
Does anyone have anything to add on this segment? If not, we will go to segment two.
Psychological readiness for early retirement requires mental and emotional preparation for transitioning from a structured work life to a self-directed lifestyle. Key challenges include the loss of routine, identity shifts, and potential social isolation. Without the daily structure work provides, retirees may feel aimless. Identity shifts occur as individuals move from defining themselves by their careers to finding new purposes. Social isolation is a risk, as work often provides essential social interactions. To prepare, plan ahead by developing hobbies, volunteer activities, or part-time work to provide structure and purpose. Engaging in meaningful activities can replace the sense of purpose work once provided. Building and maintaining social networks outside of work is crucial to prevent isolation. Staying physically and mentally active through exercise and mental stimulation supports overall well-being. By addressing these psychological aspects and planning for the emotional shifts, individuals can transition smoothly to early retirement and enjoy a fulfilling post-work life.
Jordan, you mentioned approaching financial independence as a philosopher. Can you talk about practices that you recommend for maintaining mental and emotional health?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of it is a lot of people got to financial independence because they were working and their work at one point felt purposeful and stops feeling purposeful. And so the answer becomes, let's make enough money so we don't have to work anymore. But that creates a vacuum. And this very much happened to me when I stopped being a physician. I had a panic attack because it was the only identity and purpose I had ever known. So really the idea is that we should start thinking about what we feel our true life's work really is. And that really seems daunting because people think there's this one thing we're supposed to do. But the truth of the matter is, I think there are many things we can do that feel purposeful. Some of them may feel big and important and like they're going to change the world, but a lot of them don't, and they're smaller and they're joyful tasks. They're things we want to do. So I think from a philosophical standpoint, if we're going to talk about especially leaving the workplace, if we're going to talk about enjoying these boons of financial independence, then we really have to start thinking philosophically about who we want to be and what we'd like to accomplish in this life. And then we can start putting our energy, start doing work towards those things. So again, you never really stop working. You might retire, but you don't stop working because life is about work. It's about being intentional and filling your days with activities that light you up.
How about you, Jakob? Since as a physicist, you figured out the equation. Did you have to think about purpose and things that you wanted to do? Like any loss of identity at all?
No, I think, yeah, I think in the early years, I mean, how should I explain this? So in the early years, I think those who pursued financial independence, those who were into it, all had like actually a purpose for something they wanted to do rather than the career. They were kind of like tired of their career, tired about their jobs, and they wanted to do something else. And I think as the movement got more popular and sort of got diluted a little bit in terms of message and more of it became sort of like, we got like a pop light version of it. People started seeing it as sort of like newcomers started seeing it as more sort of like a magical solution to their other problems in life. And, you know, like how to get out of a sucky job or solve personal problems, because there were these like financial independent people online who looked like they were having amazing lives. And the problem with that was once, you know, you retire without a purpose, then you quickly find out what the same thing that was like discovered that was shown in this interview or the clip you showed that freedom does not really, I mean, outside of being a cog in the machine, there's basically no structure. You have to create your own structure. And the problem with that is the way we grow up, at least middle class education, is very much focused on training that drive or that impetus for people to sort of like organize their own lives out of them. It's a lot easier to, I mean, we're essentially trained to follow along, get a job and do what's expected of us. But as soon as like there's nobody who expects anything from you, what do? You kind of like default to your maybe worst. If you don't have anything, you default to your worst instincts, right? So that's basically recreation, consumerism. Maybe you make a list, you know, you watch all the 100 greatest movies, you know, like that's going to take you like 200 hours. What do you do then, right? You travel around for like a year, then that gets boring and so on. And so after a few years, people kind of go back to work again without the purpose, I mean, I think starting, around 2015, people began to focus more on the philosophical aspects of it, you know, like in terms of like positive freedom, that is freedom to do stuff, and negative freedom, that is freedom from stuff. And so, I mean, if you Google those terms, you'll find lots of discussions now, but in the early years, that was like literally not a thing, because everybody who was like into it was all about freedom too. They did not see the sort of like the deluge of people coming in seeking freedom from. And I think this has sort of like stabilized a little bit, especially after the COVID lockdowns and the whole work from home thing, because people who like didn't like their jobs, don't like their jobs, were sort of given some incentives to keep working. If they could work from home, maybe their job wasn't as bad. And so instead of financial independence, they're like, okay, I mean, my job is pretty good now. I mean, I can do some programming from home. I can like tend the garden, do, it's better than going into the office for many people. And so I think the FIRE movement has kind of like flattened out a little bit, or at least it is at least taking a breather in that sense, that like the negative effects have sort of been ameliorated.
Yeah, and I think those who hated their job, we saw a great resignation.
Right.
We saw many people changing their careers and changing the direction of their lives. And I guess for long-term planning, it makes a lot of sense. It tends to be better for those running towards something versus just running away from something, because then you can plan a little bit better. Christy, can you share what the transition was like for you, kind of leaving a structured work environment?
Yeah, for sure. So I was not a big fan of my job. And at the time that I had become financially independent, it was becoming less and less stable. Something that I'm sure a lot of workers can relate to with AI replacing jobs. Back then it was outsourcing. And but what was very surprising was that when I actually gave my notice to my boss, I thought that I was going to be dancing out of the office and then playing his head like a bongo. But what really happened was I had a mini panic attack. And that is really due to the fact that I had been working in that job for almost a decade. So, not in that particular job, but in that career for a decade. And what happens is you inevitably become your job. It's very hard to get out of that mindset once you have built that up, and your entire identity is tied to that job. So I had to go through this whole transitional phase. Well, the best example for this is this TED Talk that I watched from Dr. Moines, and he is a retiree that I think he's in his 70s. And there's a lot of parallels between early retirement and regular retirement, because people who retire regularly at the traditional age of 65 also experience what he calls the four stages of retirement. And this is exactly what I went through. So the first stage is the honeymoon period. So I had a mini panic attack after I gave my notice. But eventually, once I started traveling, once I started getting out of the mindset, I was having a lot of fun traveling the world. So you're in this honeymoon phase for about anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, depending on the person. But then after this phase is over, you kind of get into a kind of a boredom phase, which is what Yakim was saying, which if you don't have purpose and you've left your job, even if you hated that job like I did, you still lose your sense of purpose and you're wondering what's next. Who am I? It also doesn't help whenever you meet a new person, the first question they ask is, what is it that you do? Because our jobs are so tied in with our identity. And then after you move past that phase, the third phase is the phase of reinvention, experimentation, which is you want to experiment to see, okay, now that I've lost that identity, can I build a new identity? You start to look inward and in figuring out who you really are as a person and not just your identity tied to your job. So you start experimenting, you start connecting to other networks. We are also very tied to our social networks at our jobs, and we rarely have time to venture out of those networks. So what traveling gave me was the opportunity to meet people of many different backgrounds that I would have never had the time or the opportunity to come across if I had stayed in technology. And then I met a lot of people who were world traveling with their children. They're part of a community called World Schoolers. I met a lot of digital nomads who were they actually did not feel that a full-time job would be secure at all. They actually feel like if you start your own business, that's more way more secure than having a full-time job, which is the opposite mentality that I had been taught for the last decade when I had met them. And now that digital nomadism is no longer a fringe movement after the pandemic, we can see that people are way more open to this idea. But back then, it was very fringe. So then during experimentation, I discovered that there's a lot of other ways to live besides having a full-time job. And you are not just your job. And I started looking inward and trying to figure out why are we always so driven to achieve and climb the corporate ladder? And it's always like, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? And you really get to know yourself on a very intimate level. And when you divorce yourself from that identity of who your job is. And then after the third stage of experimentation, your final stage is reinvention. So that's where you finish your experiments and you discover who you really are, the new person. And from my experimentation, I discovered that I actually really want to be an author. I really like writing. That was my childhood dream, but it was not the right financial option for me because I had grown up in poverty and I didn't really want to rely on my parents if it didn't work out. So after experimentation and reinvention, I found that this new identity suited me a lot better. And I was not happy at my old job because I was trying to become something I wasn't. I also became happier with just existing. That's another concept that's very difficult to get used to if you're constantly working because you're just treading water. There's no time to actually breathe and let the stress go away and let yourself heal. So there was a lot of healing that happened in that phase. And now I'm finally at a place in life in which I'm very happy with my identity. I'm very happy with my social networks. And it's a whole journey that happens. And there's a lot of parallels we can draw between regular retirement, traditional retirement, and early retirement to be able to see the different phases, the four phases that retirees go through. And it's a very difficult journey, but at the end of it, it is very worth it. And a lot of people are terrified to go on this journey because their identity is so tied to their job and they think that they are their job.
Thank you for sharing both your own experience and then through the context of that framework. These are things that we tend not to learn in school, but everybody has to go through it. So any insights into that is extremely helpful. Chris, how do you answer the question when people say, what do you do?
So I am kind of still working part-time, but one thing I kind of wanted to touch on as I was listening to all their answers, because I think I agree with everything they said. But one other thing I would add is people who are on this path to FIRE, you tend to get there. And I think, especially like I know Christy's backstory from reading her work, and I kind of had a similar where I didn't come from like abject poverty as much as she did, but coming from a position where we didn't have a lot, and saving just feels good. And that's part of, I think, your identity. You are a saver. So when you get to retirement, then you have to take this money you've been saving and learn to spend it. And that's a huge mental shift also for people, in addition to work providing some purpose, but being able to do some work that provides some income for me and for my wife, it's provided a sense of like being able to live and spend and enjoy it versus like kind of just always worrying about money. And because we never worried because we were saving at such a high rate. But I think if we would have had a traditional retirement without some ongoing work, in addition to losing the purpose and the connection and all those positive things that can come with work, it's also just a huge mindset shift. And particularly for somebody that is such a natural saver and that does get so much feeling of security and just feels good to save, I think there's something to be said there for thinking about, like, is retirement really what you actually want? Not only from losing that purpose, but from losing the income and all the other positive things that can come with that.
You and your wife are both natural savers?
Me? Yeah. We were living this FIRE lifestyle. We started living off of my wife's income when she was fresh out of school, probably making $35,000 a year living in Pittsburgh. And this is like 2001. So it's a bit more in today's dollars, but not a lot. And I was still in physical therapy school, and so really not making anything other than just working part-time. But we started living off of her income, and whatever I had, I was using to help her get out of debt with school loans and a car loan that she had, because my family just always, it was pounded into my head to be debt-free. And that worked. And so when my salary came online, I started just saving everything for a down payment on a house. And then once we bought our house, again, we were kind of comfortable. We bought it bought everything that we could live off our salary. So then we just kept saving my income. Like we would use one payment to pay extra on the house and one payment to start investing. So we always lived on 50% of our household income just because it felt good with, again, no plan, no goal, no idea what we were doing. It felt very good for us, and we're definitely natural savers.
Well, that can be a plan in itself, living off of 50% of your income. And you bringing up learning how or having a mindset of spending your money is the perfect segue to segment 3.
Achieving and sustaining financial independence requires effective lifestyle and expense management. This could involve adopting frugal living habits, such as reducing non-essential expenses like dining out and entertainment. Smart shopping, including buying secondhand and using coupons, helps lower costs. Sustainable choices like downsizing housing, using energy-efficient methods, and opting for fuel-efficient transportation further reduce expenses. Creating a detailed budget is essential for tracking income and spending. Maintaining an emergency fund and prioritizing debt repayment are key strategies for financial stability. Automating savings and investing in a diversified portfolio ensures steady wealth growth. Monitoring daily expenses with apps or spreadsheets helps in making informed financial decisions. Setting clear, long-term financial goals and regularly reviewing them provides motivation and direction. By consistently adjusting spending habits and financial plans, individuals can accelerate their journey toward financial independence and enjoy a secure future.
So Chris, it sounds like for you and your wife, the saving came pretty naturally. So I don't know if you ever had to maintain a budget for your household, but can you give us some sense of what it's like balancing frugality with maintaining a comfortable lifestyle?
Yeah. And to me, I guess I never really felt like we were living in like frugality because we were doing all the things we wanted. Where we focused our attention, and again, this is kind of these FIRE principles that if you listen to FIRE podcasts or read FIRE blogs or whatever, you're going to hear this over and over, but like housing, cars, and food. So again, we bought a house that we could afford off of, we could make the mortgage payments if we had to, it would have been tight, but off of one of our incomes. And then we just never really cared about cars. We always drove older, kind of crappy used cars and didn't care about that. And so by doing so and just making two professional salaries, and we lived in a lower cost of living area, so that made that more doable. We were traveling the world. I mean, we got into high altitude mountaineering, skiing. I've been to the Super Bowl. I never felt like I was living in a frugal lifestyle. And now, we both work. I work 10 hours a week and my wife works 20 hours a week. But we're really not spending down our portfolio and we live quite well. But again, we have paid off house, paid off cars. So very low taxes because we work so little and we don't earn much money anymore. So the place where most people's money goes, our money is not going there. So it's going towards travel and, good food and experiences. And so, I think if you get the big things right, which is what we focused on, we just never were super into that extreme frugality. It just wasn't part of our story.
It's nice having that nest egg. Mm-hmm. Jordan, you talk to a lot of people. Can you share some common lifestyle adjustments that you hear from the people you interview or recommend to your listeners?
Yeah, I think the key is to start early and start aggressively. So I'm a physician and I came out of the physician lifestyle. So Jim Daly, the White Coat Investor, says it best. He says, live like a resident. So when we're residents, we make very little money. And in fact, a lot of us are in debt from medical school. And so what happens is after you leave residency, you get a job as a doctor and you're making a lot more money, but you're already used to living like a resident. So if at the beginning of your career, you can, so to speak, quote unquote, live like a resident for a few years, you're going to collect a lot of money that they can then compound. And I think that's really the key. I've never been a fan of significant frugality. We always were more make a lot, spend a lot, but always make sure that there was a pretty good gap. And I think you have to decide what fits for your lifestyle. But very clearly, if you make the right moves between the ages of 20 and 30, it will serve you for the rest of your life. So my best piece of advice always is if you're going to be over frugal and if you're going to be over careful and if you're going to make a lot of money, it's always you want to do it as early as possible because that's where compounding really, really comes in.
Yeah, time's the secret weapon or one of the secret weapons.
Yeah, totally. And there's no skill involved. It's just literally you put it in there and you wait.
Christy, how can you talk a little bit about your childhood and how not having a lot of money, like how does that impact you as an adult and your relationship with money and spending?
Yeah, for sure. I grew up in a small rural village in China of 3,000 people. And back then, at one point, my family was living on 44 cents a day. So at the time, I didn't actually think that this was that different. I didn't think that that was living in poverty just because everybody around me was also living in poverty. So a lot of the sense of frugality is actually relative. I had that perspective from living in China that it could be so much worse because at the time, even though we were poor, my parents kept telling me stories about the Cultural Revolution and the type of just horrific things that they had gone through. They had gone through famine. They had gone through like multiple of my relatives were executed as a result of just being landlords, which makes me think, I'm like, I wonder if my like fear of real estate has anything to do with that weird generational trauma. But yeah, my multiple members of my family were executed. And then so my parents were always telling me, yes, we were poor and I don't have money to buy you toys. And, you know, the food that we're eating is very basic. But just be grateful that you are living, you actually have family members that love you. You have your parents to take care of you. You are not sick and the government is not after you. So just it gave me that perspective, even though I was poor. It wasn't until after I came to Canada, we immigrated, that I realized how poor we were living and that it was not normal to have stomach worms. It was not normal to never have drank a can of Coke. And it was the most valuable possession I had at this time. I wouldn't even throw out the can. It really gave me that perspective. And I think that it helped me and also hurt me in both ways when it came to financial independence, because it helped me in that becoming an optimizer was very easy. I say optimizer instead of saver because in some ways I did spend a lot of money on travel, but I didn't spend a lot of money on housing or transportation because travel was part of my value. So being an optimizer meant that you spend money on things that you really care about and you maximize the value that you get from it instead of just buying the cheapest thing. And that was very easy for me. Because that was part of my identity growing up, because out of necessity, because I never chose to be poor, but that was the cards that I was dealt. However, it did hurt me in terms of investing because I was terrified of investing. And the funny thing is, right when we started investing, right after that, 2008 happened. So that was the perfect way to, that was my training wheels into investing, is like, I'm terrified of investing. I grew up in poverty and then boom, financial crisis, perfect time to learn how to invest. So you kind of have to have this. So I'm grateful that because my husband is more of an optimist, because he grew up in regular middle-class circumstances. So he didn't have that poverty mindset, ate every penny in that mindset. We had a good combination between optimist and pessimist. So I would say definitely if you are an optimizer, that will help you towards FIRE, but don't be stuck in this tunnel vision mindset that you're going to be missing out on opportunities, because investing is a huge opportunity and it is for the long term and it's not a day-to-day change. You don't look at the stock market every day and then just pull your money in and out. It's the long term. So I would say, yes, my childhood gave me a leg up, but it also hurt me in other ways. And it's not anyone's fault if they ever grew up poor. They did not choose to be in that situation, but just have the perspective that you need to change your perspective when you are, so that you don't miss out on opportunities as well.
Yeah, great perspective. And, you know, gives an appreciation for things that we do have, gratitude. Jakob, extreme frugality. I mean, living on $6,000 per person, how do you balance enjoying life versus saving?
Huge philosophical difference between the FIRE movement's perspective on money and the ERE perspective on early retirement extreme, or my philosophy on money, in the sense that the FIRE movement is like all about money, you know, like it's like the hammer that people have, and if all you have is a hammer, then the entire world is a nail. And so FIRE kind of goes, it has sort of like a range of perspectives within the money perspective, namely from, it goes from like scarcity-oriented mindset, which is kind of like the beginner's level and tops out at like the money optimized aspect of a beginner. And it's very hard to get out of this mindset when you just kind of like see everything in terms of like how much you spend, how much something costed, or what you had to give up, or how can you like optimize the budget and find whatever you want to spend your money in. So the difference between FIRE and ERE is that ERE tends to add more tools to that toolbox. So we don't really look at as much at what things cost and how we can best spend our money, but like how can we learn all these other skills that we somehow can creatively combine to find solutions outside the consumer economy. And these are basically tools that our grandparents knew. I mean, it's not something that's like difficult to learn. It's just not quick and easy. It takes time, you know, how to learn, learning how to cook, how to fry an egg, how to cook a great meal, how to fix a drain, you know, like a freight table, like how to build a clock or fix a clock, how to do electronics repairs and so on without calling in an expert and having to work money to pay that, work to earn money to pay that expert. And I say our grandparents, because this whole like transition, I think, started happening in the 1990s when this kind of like whole efficiency thinking entered our schools. A lot of like classes, woodworking, sewing, household was taken out of the school system. And people thought, well, you just got to sit behind a computer and learn how to type really fast and code, you know, because it's more optimal if everybody just earns as much money as they can to pay other people to do that. And so, and it kind of goes back to what Jordan said about like living like a resident, because when you start out, if you're lucky enough to sort of like get this when in your 20s, when you're not really locked into like a big mortgage and an expensive car, you can just kind of keep living like a student. But when we say that, you got to consider that at 6,000, I'm like living like a student, but a student with, you know, like 25 years of experience learning other skills and so on. So I can do way more, for example, cooking than just eating spaghetti and ketchup. You know, like when I cook, I just go into my backyard and then pick up stuff, you know, for free. It comes like, I mean, it's like magic, you know, like free food comes out of the ground when I put seeds in. Whereas other people, they go to work, then they drive over to the supermarket, then they buy this stuff if they know how to cook. Otherwise, they go to a restaurant and so on. So a lot of money is wasted there. So in terms of money, I don't see it sort of like as money spent as being directly proportional to standard of living. And so like erroneously conclude because I don't spend a lot, you know, like I must live a sad, sad life. Rather, I see spending money as resolving the remaining friction in my life, which is only there because I didn't design my systems very well. I mean, a perfect solution for me is like a creative solution I can do completely independent of the economy. If I spend money, it's because I've somehow failed. And I can tell that like 60% of our budget actually goes to real estate taxes. And most of those real estate taxes goes to paying like old pension plans from the government. So we're not really getting anything out of that. So we're actually living on less than you know, like we could live if we just moved out of here, we could live on less than that. So we've essentially like closed all the resource loops in that sense by continually learning new skills and how to like not just technical skills, but also like connecting with people, learning from them. If they need something I have, you know, I fix their stuff, they give me cookies or something, you know. So it's overall sort of like way more integrated in that sense. So as I said, from my perspective, the whole frugality thing is a little bit of a red herring. I don't really see it like that at all.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is taking a step back in time.
In a way, yeah. I mean, you're going back to sort of like 1950s thinking, but with all the modern technology, especially the internet, right? I mean, if the internet has really been a blessing in that sense, if you need to know something, YouTube is like a gold mine. You can typically find someone who's already solved the problem.
Yeah.
And shows you exactly what needs to be done. It used to be that you'd have to like own several books. You need to have an uncle who was like a plumber or something. And you'd call him desperately. But now you can like pretty much learn how to fix a car from YouTube. I mean, that's like one of the few good things that the internet has brought about.
Interesting perspective. I love it because it doesn't mean that you have to make a massive sacrifice. And I think it's a good way to live.
And it also gives you something like interesting to do, right? You're constantly learning, right? You're not just sitting around, you know, like watching TV or playing video games.
Yes, I have one issue with a valve that needed replacement. And I was so close to trying to do it myself. But in the end, I called the plumber because I thought that I should not be using the torch. I don't think I'm qualified.
It does require some like thinking and catching yourself. I mean,
I was so close. I had the torch in hand. I was ready to go. And then I said, my wife's voice popped in my head.
But yeah, I mean, you need to self-educate like a vast repository of skills. But then you also need, and this is something I think has been lost in the past few generations, you need the creativity to combine these laterally instead of like immediately go into the mindset of, well, the only way I can possibly solve this is to buy a product or hire an expert.
Yeah,
because we're very much used to thinking in terms of solutions to problems as a product you buy, not something you sort of like make up. It's like this thing can only be used for this particular, you know, like it's kind of like cog and machine kind of thinking. Right. I mean, I propped up my laptop here to get a somewhat better angle here. I could have like bought like a, actually, here's a better example. I don't know if you can see this thing here. I could have bought like a professional stand for my microphone, but instead I just made my own. Right. It's stuff like that. I mean, that one there is like for a virtual reality headset that I got for free from one of my forum friends. And he didn't, I mean, he asked if he should send the, what are they called, like the stands. And I said, no, never mind. I mean, I'm just going to like build them myself and then screw them directly into the table that I also built myself. And instead of hiring like a cabinet maker to perfectly fit my tables and furniture into my house, I build it myself so it matches, you know, like dimensions. I'm not suffering from furniture that's either too big or too small. It doesn't fit me. I'm a little bit too tall compared to like the average person. So if I buy furniture, it doesn't really, you know, like it's uncomfortable. So I can make all these like bespoke, you know, like solutions to all the problems I have.
So, I love it.
Hence, I don't really think of it as frugality. It's not a sacrifice. It's a gain.
Well said. With that, we're going to move to segment 4.
Ensuring your retirement savings last requires strategic investment choices. Dividend investing offers an income stream with stocks that consistently pay and grow dividends, providing a cushion against inflation. Reinvesting these dividends can amplify your wealth over time. Rental properties generate steady monthly income while offering tax benefits. They provide a tangible asset that can appreciate. Index funds offer broad market exposure, balancing the risks of individual securities. By maintaining a mix of stock and bond index funds, you can achieve a stable and rewarding investment portfolio. Diversifying across various asset classes such as stocks, bonds, real estate, and cash mitigates risk. Regular rebalancing ensures your portfolio aligns with your retirement goals. To manage longevity risk, consider dynamic withdrawals, adjusting your spending based on market performance. Annuities can provide a lifetime income, safeguarding against outliving your savings. Delaying Social Security benefits increases your monthly income, enhancing financial security in later years. Implementing these strategies can help you enjoy a secure, fulfilling retirement.
So curious how the panel thinks about investing. I'm wondering if it's very similar or if there are differences. Jordan, you want to start? Like, how do you determine the right balance between different asset classes with your investments?
So for me, the way I look at it is I would like to get the most return, obviously, with the least risk. And so I know, for instance, that there are things I love doing in this post quote unquote retirement life that still make money. And so because there's some things I like doing, like my hospice work, I do it even if I wasn't being paid for it. But a side effect of doing it is I get paid for it. So for me, I know, for instance, my asset allocation can be a little bit more aggressive. And so I am heavily equities based with much less bonds because I know I have an income stream. I'm not worried about the ups and downs as much. And it makes things easier for me. I think there are lots of different ways to work your asset allocation. And a lot of them are really personal. we know there are lots of really good ways to bucket your investments for retirement. And for each person, it actually has less to do with returns and more to do with comfort. And so I'm very comfortable with having I'm very comfortable with having a high equity allocation. But there are a lot of people who don't. There are a lot of people, for instance, who want a defined income. And so for them, they'll eventually pick annuities. And so they'll decrease their returns a little bit in order to have stability. I think there's so many different good asset allocations. It's more of what you mentally feel most comfortable with.
Jakob, what's the physicist's approach to the investment?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to plus one on that. I believe in the swan philosophy, which is sleep well at night. So as long as you know you sleep well, if you sleep well at night when the market goes down, for example, on a sustained basis, then you have the right investments. I mean, I might be slightly biased there. I mean, in the very beginning, I think one of the videos said something about accumulating 25 times your annual spend, right? So like I'm at 180 these days, so I can like afford not to care. As a physicist, I would say, or like just as me being me, I believe that one should be an informed investor. One should know what one is investing in. I'm not really sure anything good comes out of like I invest in this because guru on the internet said so and so. So when people ask me investment questions, I usually hand them like a bunch of finance and economics textbooks, like from first year business school, which is like, you know, like probably about 2000 pages. And I say something like, read those and come back and ask again, because I really like people to be informed about what they're investing in. I don't think like a brochure is good enough, but that's just me.
Yeah. We're getting to know you. I mean, a guy who will fix his own clocks in the basement. You're also going to have an understanding of what you own in your investment portfolio.
I think so, because I mean the other reason is like, I mean, when people, I mean, FIRE is essentially like one part, you know, you work your career, you understand your job pretty well, and then you transition into capital income. So it seems sort of like natural to me that you should also understand that pretty well, because at least in terms of identity, as a retired person, you are sort of like a private money manager for yourself. I mean, would you really occupy that position without having a clue about what you're doing? That just seems sort of like insane to me.
Christy, you mentioned starting investing and then 2008 financial crisis came. How has that played out? Did you stick with it? And then can you, do you have a swan approach, sleep well at night?
I think that investing in 2008 has contributed to shortening my lifespan by at least 5 or 10 years in the long run. So coming from, and also at the time, just from also worrying, like in tech, I always worried about my job security, even though it seems like tech is a lot more job, has quite a lot of job security. Because at the time I graduated into a dot-com crisis. Not a lot of people, the next generation will really know what that's about. But at the time I thought that we would graduate and then not be able to find jobs. And then tech really took off, but then now we're kind of pulling back a little bit. Being hired in tech and then laid off. So at the time I was trying to struggle with the concept of investing and I was worried about my job security, and then 2008 at the same time. But what that taught me is, even if you, like, that's basically equivalent of jumping into the deep end without knowing how to swim. I would advocate for people to actually gradually wade into the water so that they actually can get a sense of what it feels like when the market plummets, and not to freak out and pull your money back out. Because that's the worst thing you could possibly do in investing. Okay, disregarding all the allocations like 90-10, 75-25, 60-40, whatever. None of that matters if you cannot hold on when there's a market crash and all you do is just sell and then buy back in when you think that the just randomly trying to time the market and then dancing in and out of the market. There's no allocation that will fix that. So the most important thing is to be able to hold when there's a downturn. And learning from my 2008 experience, it was definitely not fun. And if I were to do it again, I would have liked something that was a little bit more gradual to get me used to it. But on the plus side, because I jumped into the deep end, no matter what happens in the market now, I can go easily swan. I can easily sleep at night. For example, like even during the coronavirus, people were freaking out and saying the markets are going to collapse. People are going to lose their jobs. I slept perfectly fine. I knew that I had gone through 2008. I knew that 2008 was much worse than what happened during the pandemic, and so that experience made it so that everything else seemed very easy in comparison. And with all the lurching from crisis to crisis since then, has taught me that every single time when people say it's going to be different this time, it's not different. It's going to be fine. So from my 2008 experience, I learned that it could always be worse, and I have been through the worst. So don't try to dance in and out of the market. That's the best thing you can do. And it really is about mental fortitude more than the allocation. You can always change your allocation. And sometimes when, as you age, you start to go towards more stable allocation, or maybe you like found a passion project that earns you a lot of money and you decide to go more aggressive. That's fine. It's not set in stone. You can always change your allocation. But the mental fortitude to not sell during market dips is the mark of a true seasoned investor.
Chris, your thoughts?
I think in addition to like that mental aspect, there is like a balance of you have to have enough growth when you have a long retirement, which kind of implies you're going to have some volatility with that. So that's one risk. But then, you know, the other risk, so that you have to have that longevity. So there's two sides of that you have to balance. And you kind of have to get that right if you're like right on that, you know, if you have the 25 times your assets and you're drawing down 4%, like was mentioned in the video. But the nice thing, like, again, if you can have some little bit of income and you have some work you enjoy, like, which has kind of been our approach, we're drawing down at such a low rate that there's much more lowers the risk, and it much makes it much less important to get that perfect, that balancing those risks. And so like Jakob's is pretty extreme. Like, I think he said 187 times his expenses or something. But even if you're, you know, if you can get to where you're drawing down 3 or 2.5%, the risk is extremely low at that point. I think where it's most important is, you know, if you really are just desperate and you want to retire like right on the, you know, as soon as you can, then you really have to be watching your investments much more closely, and it is going to be a bit more stressful. But the more cushion you have, then the less perfect you have to be, and the more relaxed you can be about it.
Very helpful. Yeah, very thoughtful. With that, this is a fantastic panel. I'm learning so much from those who are already retired. If you're watching, thank you for joining us. Leave a comment where you're watching from, and we're going to wrap it up and go to segment 5, our last segment.
Creating a resilient financial plan for early retirement requires careful risk assessment, income diversification, and contingency planning. Assess financial risks like market volatility and inflation by maintaining a diversified portfolio and including assets like equities and real estate. Health insurance and health savings accounts are vital for covering medical expenses before Medicare eligibility. Diversify income sources to reduce reliance on a single stream. Consider part-time consulting, freelance projects, rental income, dividends from stocks, and interest from bonds. Explore passive income opportunities like real estate and digital products. Maintain an emergency fund with 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses, and ensure adequate insurance coverage, including health, life, and disability insurance to protect against significant financial disruptions. Develop flexible spending plans that adjust based on investment performance and personal needs. Regularly review and update your plan to adapt to life changes and economic conditions. With an adaptable plan, you can ensure long-term financial stability and enjoy a secure early retirement.
Chris, when you've established this nest egg that gives you a lot of flexibility, do you need to regularly review and update a financial plan?
I mean, I think circumstances always change, so I don't think you can ever just put things completely on autopilot. And you have to be aware of, you know, how the world's changing around you, if even if for no other reason than if you want to increase your spending, whether to improve your quality of life or to start giving more and giving sooner. And I think that's one of the best things you can do with your money. I think it's always worth keeping up with things. But again, I think the more cushion you have, the less you have to be stressed and worrying about it. And you don't have to be as perfect. But I don't think you ever just want to turn it off and put it on autopilot.
Jakob, do you feel that you have a financial plan in place?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I'm also not a fan of autopilot, or rather, I'm not a fan of like fire and forget methods. So I do pay attention, but I'm not nearly as interested in financial matters as I used to be.
How often are you making adjustments?
I mean, I reinvest dividends, but the last time I sold something, so like I'm an individual stock picker, so that changes things a little bit. But it's sort of like a very low turnover. So like maybe every 2-3 years, there'll be one position change.
Okay.
So you're it's just not a whole lot of effort. I mean, people think, he must be like analyzing stocks like all day long. And I mean, I do know people who do that, but that's because they're into it. I'm not really anymore. People might know that I used to be a quant for a few years after retiring. That was kind of like a fun thing to do. But eventually I lost interest. I seem to have like a 5-year attention span for whatever I get into. And so now it's just sort of sitting there. And I think I invest mostly sort of like for tax optimization and not so much to like gain alpha or gain an edge. I think my priority is more in terms of reducing beta than increasing alpha.
Stated like a quant. How about you, Christy? How do you ensure that a financial plan, stays on track and can remain resilient amidst changing global economic conditions? Since you talked about all the crises that keep happening.
Yes. There's questions that we get asked the most from our readers is, when stock markets are too high, they're like, it's too high, it's going to crash. I don't think now's a good time to buy in. And then when the stock market's dipping, it's like, no, everything's going to hell. I don't think I should buy now. I'm going to lose everything. So there's really no good time to get in. And people are always going to have those fears. What I find is really helpful, especially if there's a couple, especially if you have opposite personalities, like I do with my husband, because one is an optimist, one's a pessimist. So of course, my husband's going to want to have a much more aggressive allocation. I'm going to have to, I want more risk off for me. But what we do is we have quarterly financial reviews so that we can talk about what our thoughts are going forward and how, so that we're both comfortable with it. Because the worst thing you could do is having both partners go in opposite directions and then your portfolio is just all over the place and nobody really knows what the other person is doing. And especially now that we have a child, we want to be more flexible in terms of where we want to live, in terms of how much risk we want to take on for our portfolio. We actually want to take on less risk. We are more valuing stability. Also, when you get older, as you get older, you want more stability, but you also want a higher quality of life. You start spending on more comfort-based things. When I was 20 years old, I was perfectly fine riding a bus and like going through South America and sharing a bus with a bunch of chickens. That's not going to happen anymore. I need my hotels. I need my flights. And like comfort is become a lot more important. So it's always good to talk to your significant other to make sure that you're on the same page and definitely have quarterly reviews. And then after we have the reviews, we like to have a little reward to, because it shouldn't always be just about numbers and talking about math. You should reward yourself with like a nice dinner afterwards or just something to look forward to every time you do your financial reviews. So it helps to be on the same page and don't get stuck on, I've made my financial plan. This is going to be the plan set in stone for the rest of my life and nothing's ever going to change.
Jordan, what role does healthcare planning play in your approach to building a resilient financial plan?
Yeah, I think obviously having appropriate health insurance is really important. If you are firing and leaving a job, then you have to have an alternative. Are you going to go to healthcare.gov? Are you going to look at sharing ministries? Are you going to look at, what are you going to do in order to make sure you get insurance? But I think there's also something to think about. As you get older, it is true, our healthcare costs increase. On the other hand, the other side of that is, as you get older, we tend to spend less because we do less. And so I think it's really hard to know exactly what you're going to need as you get older. In the old days, a lot of us could have afforded and gotten long-term care insurance. A lot of people have trouble with that. They're now self-insuring. So, you know, it makes sense, at least part of your risk mitigation strategy, because we're really talking about risk mitigation. Once you've kind of hit that financial place you want to be, what you're really looking at is, how do we mitigate risk going into the future? And so a lot of people are self-insuring and are bucketing a certain amount of money in less aggressive, more conservative investments that'll be available for them for healthcare expenditures. So I think we have to think about it. We have to look at what insurance options are available. And then you have to be conscious, at least, of self-funding.
Chris, you want to share any final thought on retiring early?
Again, I think for me, my thought process has evolved a lot. Like, it was originally about retiring because I do think I was burning out on my original career. And the, you know, once I kind of started to make changes and started realizing, you know, again, the stress of the drawdown, the things you lose from work, I've much more evolved. And I think I'm much more in alignment, like, with where Jordan is now, with, you know, work is probably always going to be a part of my life to some degree, even if it's not paid work. And in a lot of ways, paid work, I think, is more rewarding. Like, I've done some volunteer things, and in a lot of ways I was restricted. And so by doing some things, I guess maybe my way I've evolved and thought about it now is, when you're being paid, it's somebody's paying you because you're adding value to somebody in some way. And there's something to be said for that. So retirement is just kind of not a very big deal to me. I guess the only reason I focus on, you know, if you have enough to retire, is a lot of times you don't choose to retire. So maybe you get sick. Maybe, you know, your industry changes or goes away or something like that. So there is value in knowing if you know have enough that you could retire. But to me, I think in a lot of ways, it's the wrong goal. So it's not a huge priority.
Christy, any final thought?
So throughout the 10 years that I have been retired, in the very beginning, it was really about getting away from my job. It was really about fulfilling the dream of traveling the world. But now that I'm in my 40s and I've had a child, and we've actually had some very serious family emergencies in the past 5 years, what it has helped me realize is that financial independence is really a tool to give you the space and time to follow your priorities. So in our case, so last year, my father-in-law passed away from brain cancer. And he had been fighting the disease for over 3 years, ever since the pandemic set in. And what's really ironic is, life has this weird way of throwing things at you. So at the time that my father-in-law was passing away, I was also pregnant with my son. So having to deal with just, like, he was in hospice care, and the whole family rallied around him to take care of him for his last days. And then at the same time, struggling to learn how to become a mom. And then my husband was losing his father while becoming a father for the first time himself, made me really realize what my life priorities are. It's not really creating my job. It's not traveling the world. It's family. It's being with the people that you love and giving them the time and space that they deserve. And if we had not become financially independent, we would have had to worry about our jobs. We would have had multiple priorities to juggle. But because we had the portfolio taking care of our expenses, we could just concentrate and spend, basically put all our time and effort towards making sure that he was taken care of, and that he would know that he was loved on his last days, and also taking care of my infant when he was born. And I think that's the best money that you will ever not spend. Basically, the best money you will never spend, because it's actually towards priorities, and it's better than any car or house or luxury purse or anything you've ever bought. That's what financial independence is actually about.
Yeah, wise financial choices, and then it ends up not being about the money. Jakob, I get the sense from all the things that you talk about, it's not really FIRE movement. Like, you see it as a way of just being a better citizen. It's like being a responsible individual.
Yeah, I mean, like, in, I think it was like in 1930 or 1929, John Maynard Keynes wrote, like, published a small letter. I think it's called something like Letter to My Grandchildren, where he predicted that productivity over the next 100 years would increase by, like, about fourfold. that people would be four times as efficient to per person per work hour. And that pretty much came through, and he kind of asked the future, what are you going to do with all this productivity? And he posed that as a moral question, you know, like, what should we do with all this abundant wealth? And he kind of left it up to us. And it kind of turned out that what humans actually did was just to buy four times as much stuff and throw away four times as much things. But I think the thing with the FIRE movement essentially points out that there is actually an alternative, which is closer to what I think he had in mind, a sort of like the more idealistic thing that pretty much, I mean, it's a standard thing. It's kind of like with the internet when, or TV for that matter, when a new technology is first entered, we have all these like high expectations of what it's going to be used for. But it kind of turns out that it's, people are just, humans are going to human, right? But at least we can use this productivity to live a pretty good life and only have to work 5 or 10 years if we want to. And it's a possibility that's open to pretty much everyone. For some, it'll be on easy mode. If you have like a high income, for example, all you got to do is learn how to live like a normal person, like a median person. If you have a, you know, like a median or a low income, like grad student income, you have to put in some more effort, but it's not like exceedingly difficult to learn this. It just takes time. It's basically everything you should have learned about life from age like 5 to 20, right? You just have to learn it from age, you know, like 25 to 50 instead.
Jordan, leave us with a final nugget.
Yeah, I mean, you've got five people here, five different budgets, five different asset allocations, five different philosophies. The truth of the matter is it's about being intentional and gamifying your life to live how you want to live. The details actually matter a lot less than you think.
Well said. Well, I want to thank all the panelists for their time and insights today. Thank you, Inspired Moneymakers, for joining us. My call to action for you today is get started on your financial independence journey. And I love this idea of just think about this equation and take some inventory, take some thought. How is it that you can control your expenses? And then from there, take a look at the other side and see where you are today and where you want to be going tomorrow. Once again, thank you to our panelists. You can find Jakob Lundfisker, author of Early Retirement Extreme. You can find him at earlyretirementextreme.com. Christy Shen and Bryce Leung, they are at millennial-revolution.com. Jordan Grummet, also known as Doc G, you can find him at earnandinvest.com. And Chris Mamula, co-author of the book, Choose FI, Your Blueprint to Financial Independence. You can find him at caniretireyet.com. It was a fantastic conversation today. The next Inspired Money episode will be about the mindset of abundance, unlocking your financial potential. I'm juggling the scheduling right now. It looks like we're going to land on Monday, July 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern, but stay tuned. Gay Hendricks, American psychologist, writer, and teacher in the field of personal growth, is expected to be a panelist. He wrote the book, The Big Leap, Conquer Your Hidden Fear and Take Life to the Next Level. Transform your habits and transform your life. Until then, do something that scares you, because that's where the magic happens. Thanks, everyone.